It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here as we explore promising new developments in veterinary technology and treatments and how the field of vet medicine is advancing. Join the conversation about pet health. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David Vail is a professor of veterinary medical oncology and investigator for comparative oncology clinical trials at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine and UW Carbone Cancer Center. Dr. Vail, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Pleasure to be here.
And Julia Bates here as well, small animal internal medicine specialist serving animal hospitals in the greater Madison, Milwaukee, and Janesville areas. Dr. Bates, welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Dr. Bates, let's start with you. As an internist, you treat a wide variety of ailments in pets. What particular health issues in dogs and cats and other animals do you see most frequently?
That's a good question. I probably see a lot of GI disease or gastrointestinal disease, cats that are vomiting, cats and dogs that are vomiting or having diarrhea or not eating. Also, probably the second most common things are a lot of endocrine diseases, meaning diseases that affect our endocrine system, like diabetes mellitus, things like Cushing's disease, where the adrenal glands are overactive and producing too much stress hormone cortisol. So those would be the two groups of diseases I probably see most commonly. And then, unfortunately, as internists, we tend to diagnose a lot of cancer and send things along to Dr. Vail.
Dr. Vail, you, as Dr. Bates said, specialize in oncology. What are some indicators that a dog may have cancer?
Yeah, most of the indicators, of course, are fairly nonspecific. So noticing weight loss and prolonged weight loss, decreased appetite, abnormal swellings, of course, if they occur on the outside, on the skin, for example, are one of the early signs. And certainly if that swelling or lump persists or doesn't go away fairly quickly, sores that don't heal, difficulty eating or swallowing, any type of bleeding or discharge from a body cavity, for example, lameness, certainly, especially in our larger breed dogs. So you kind of get the flavor that these are pretty non-specific clinical signs that are occurring in an aged population that may or may not be associated with cancer, certainly. But those are some of the early indications.
There's also that fast-spreading cancer, that hemangiosarcoma, where you might need like emergency intervention. What is happening inside a dog with that type of cancer?
Yeah, so hemangiosarcoma is unfortunately a common cancer that we deal with that arises from blood vessels. And the vast majority of dogs that develop hemangiosarcoma, it occurs on the inside of the body, either in an organ called the spleen or sitting next to the heart. And it can grow merrily away without causing any symptoms at all. These patients generally feel absolutely normal with a normal quality of life until a catastrophic event occurs, usually associated with the tumor rupturing and having a bleed internally. And that's where all of a sudden a perfectly healthy, normal dog with a normal appetite will collapse because of blood loss and shock. And that requires immediate intervention. And as I said, it's unfortunately a really common tumor. If you have had enough dogs, unfortunately, we tend to outlive our companions. I've certainly lost personally dogs to this disease.
We're talking about veterinary care with UW School of Veterinary Medicine researcher Dr. David Vail is here and small animal internal medicine specialist Dr. Julia Bates. You can join in on pet health, your questions and comments front and center, 800-642-1234. Dr. Bates, what technology and diagnostic tools do veterinary specialists now have to diagnose and treat pets with cancer and other serious diseases?
I think, you know, veterinary medicine diagnostics have advanced significantly, probably over the last 20 years. You know, now every day everyday diagnostic tools are, one would be ultrasound. So now that's much more readily available. That's something that I do a lot of in my practice. And a lot of general or family practitioners are learning that skill and providing that within their general practice clinic as well. CT is another one that has come a long way. I mean, it's used a lot in human medicine. It's kind of the almost the go-to diagnostic for many things in human medicine, but it's much more accessible now. I think that's really the big thing is accessibility with diagnostics. Whereas CT was really only available at the vet school for many years up until, 5 or 6 years ago. Now there are multiple CTs across the state, so it's much easier to get more advanced diagnostics. And MRI, that would be another one. MRIs are readily available. I mean, there are at least 4 or 5 of them across the state as well. And I mean, so those are some of the really advanced big diagnostic. Endoscopy is another thing that I do, which allows us to get biopsy or tissue samples from the GI tract or other body cavities of animals as a less invasive technique. So it's like we put a scope down into the stomach and into the small intestine, or we can put it up into the urinary bladder or into the nasal and sinus cavities. So we have a lot of advanced diagnostic capabilities, which I think which make help us do a better job in identifying and diagnosing disease, which then allows us to make better decisions as far as therapeutic and treatment options, and ultimately helping our furry family members live a longer, happier life.
Dr. Vail, you oversee clinical trials. What medical findings are really on the cutting edge now about clinical trial research into cancer? And as we listen to Dr. Bates on the diagnostic side, what is happening on the clinical research side?
Yeah, all really good questions. And as Dr. Bates had mentioned, a lot of it has to do with diagnostics, advanced imaging, and the standard of care in people often is things like PET CT scan, which also gives you functional assessments of what's going on. We certainly have that available here. But from a standpoint of diagnostics for the general population, when it comes to cancer, of course, the holy grail would be something less invasive or less expensive, like a simple blood test. And there's been a lot of breakthroughs in diagnostics looking for blood-borne biomarkers of disease, including and especially cancer. And so that's become very important, and looking for those biomarkers in our clinical trials and biomarkers of response to advanced or cutting-edge therapies, which we're applying in our clinical trials. So if we start a treatment that has potentially side effects, and we have to wait 3 months to determine whether a tumor is responding, if we had a simple blood test, for example, that could tell us who's responding and who's not responding, even before imaging could tell us, that would certainly be helpful to our clients and allow a patient to either continue on therapy or come off a therapy if it's not being effective and move on to something else.
And it would be just amazing to develop a vaccine that prevents your dog from developing tumors in the first place. Is that
Absolutely.
possible?
We believe it is. There are certainly trials going on both in veterinary oncology and what we call comparative oncology, which is this kind of one medicine or one health approach where we're trying to advance that technology by using our parallel patient population of companion dogs and cats. So these are all pets that develop cancer. Unfortunately, the cancer rates are as high in our dog and cat populations as they are in people. They're the number one cause of morbidity and mortality in the aging dog population, for example. And so we currently are involved in the largest clinical trial for cancer interventional trial in the history of veterinary oncology. And that indeed is investigating a prophylactic, that is a preventative cancer vaccine that's agnostic of tumor type. That means that it may prevent or theoretically could prevent cancers of all kinds rather than a specific type. We also have trials looking at specific cancers, and you've already mentioned hemangiosarcoma. We're about to launch a very large anti-hemangiosarcoma vaccine trial as well.
It makes me wonder, like, our kids get the HPV vaccine, which can prevent cervical cancer.
Great example.
Is that what we're kind of in this research you're doing? Is that kind of a parallel on the human side?
It's a bit of a parallel. So the
Okay.
papilloma vaccine, of course, that's you're targeting an infectious agent that is known to, in a percentage of the population, eventually result in a particular cancer. So that's preventing an infectious disorder that is associated with the cancer. For a true prophylactic cancer vaccine, what we're talking about is informing or educating a patient's own immune system ahead of time what to look for in an abnormal cancer cell and kill it before it actually forms a measurable tumor.
Dr. David Vail, veterinary medical oncology professor at UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Julia Bates here, small animal internal medicine specialist. Be part of the conversation, any point, pet health. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to Mona in Madison for suggesting we discuss breakthroughs in veterinary care. Mona told us they especially want to highlight UW Veterinary Care's Small Animal Hospital.
We've had many, many pets cared for by cardiology and internal medicine and dental and just all kinds of the specialty services there have just been terrific.
Be part of the conversation, any point on pet health. Call in with a question or share a comment like Mona did. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. David Vail is a veterinary medical oncology professor at UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And Dr. Julia Bates here as well, small animal internal medicine specialist serving animal hospitals. Dr. Bates, just less than half of pet owners have health insurance to cover veterinary treatment, and the cost associated with testing and the use of technology on pets can be really steep and expensive. And Valerie from Madison wants to hear more about vet care affordability for people and how people are responding to these high vet bills.
That's a great question. The human-animal bond is an amazing one, and without it, certainly Dr. Vail and I would not have a job. Luckily, people love their pets as much as we love our own, and it's tough. The good news is more and more people do have pet health insurance, which helps a lot, but the cost of veterinary medical care is rising significantly. And there's just no easy answer. I think looking into health insurance can be helpful, but a lot of people will forego a lot of things to provide care for their pets. That's always the hardest part for me, is seeing people who will not pay their rent or, choose not to do something else to provide care. There's not an easy answer to it, because the cost of care is not going to be going down anytime soon. And with all of these new advancements and technology, that's going to help the cost of care continue to increase. So I think one of the best things that we can do is encourage people to either set up their own health savings account for their pet or to invest in health insurance early while it's more affordable. Because certainly owners with health insurance have the ability to really get more advanced care, and a lot of those health insurance companies will pay for chemotherapy or pay for radiation therapy, all things which tend to be very expensive over and above routine care.
Dr. Vail, do clinical trials cover the costs of medical treatment for the animals enrolled?
Yeah, so it depends on the clinical trial, but some of our clinical trials pay for all of the care, including diagnostics, after an initial diagnosis has been made, and some will even backfill the cost of the diagnosis. Some will pay for the novel new treatment, and others, like the preventative cancer trial, will also put dollars towards a diagnosis of cancer, and those patients that are followed over 5 years in that trial that may or may not develop cancer. So yeah, there are certainly economic advantages to getting involved in a clinical trial. You know, we wish, as Dr. Bates had mentioned, that all of our clients came in with third-party payers insurance, like on the human side, but the penetrance is still less than 10% in this country, whereas in some countries, in Europe, for example, the penetrance is almost 100% for pet insurance.
Wow. Dr. Bates mentioned chemotherapy. Dr. Vail, we heard from Matt in Madison, sent an email along and is wondering, are we running out of chemotherapy drugs to treat dog cancer patients that might be similar with the supply chain issues with people?
Yeah, globally, that's a problem. You can't pick up a newspaper or go on the internet without seeing an article on the lack of availability of what used to be commonly available chemotherapeutics. And we're seeing the same thing. And as a matter of fact, it may even be more of a problem in veterinary oncology, because certainly those drugs are being prioritized based on the health needs of human patients.
What are the side effects like for a chemotherapy treatment? Would it be similar in things you see for a human going through it?
Yeah, we're certainly getting better at alleviating or preventing side effects with some of the newer drugs that we have and the newer chemotherapeutics we have. And chemotherapy is a major part of cancer therapy. We're certainly looking at other forms of treatment that may or may not have less adverse events or side effects, but we tend in veterinary oncology to place the quality of life of our patients as our prime objective. We want to turn cancer, perhaps not cure it if that's not easily possible, but change it into a chronic disease that still maintains a really good quality of life. So in some cases, we may not be as aggressive as on the human side, certainly.
And Dr. Bates, you know, time is still important, trying to catch something early. And of course, doing that preventative care and preventative checkups can help that. But can vets confirm a diagnosis now more quickly and accurately with the advancements in technology that you're using and the lab tests that are available? Is that helpful in catching things early?
That's a good question. And Dr. Vail may be able to better speak about some of those new blood tests out there that talk about diagnosing cancer early. I believe they're mostly looking for inflammatory markers, or acute inflammatory markers, which can be suggestive of cancer. They can also give you false positives. Mm. I've seen quite a few dogs recently that have had these tests run. And so we're going on a cancer hunt because the values come back increased. And thankfully, in those patients that I've seen anyway, I haven't found evidence of cancer in those patients. But most importantly, it's the owners, I think, are the biggest part, like seeing something subtle. For example, I just saw a dog the other day that the owners just noted that the dog seemed to be losing weight. And unfortunately, you know, they took the dog in and they did some blood work, which the blood work raised concern about other diseases. And then going on a search, we unfortunately found that the dog, had cancer. We're still waiting to identify exactly what type of cancer it is, but, thankfully the owners said, hey, there's something wrong. And then they went in to see their family veterinarian, who said, hey, we need to do more diagnostic testing. And so it all starts with what's going on at home. And so if an owner thinks something is wrong, the best thing that you can do is reach out to your family veterinarian. And if things aren't going, you know, if we're not making headway, then potentially, you know, considering referral to a specialist, which may be able to help direct diagnostics in a more streamlined approach.
Veterinarians Julia Bates and David Vail sharing breakthroughs in veterinary medicine and fielding your questions about your pet's ailments. You can be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about advancements in vet medicine and diagnostic tools, treatments, and how to provide compassionate care for our pets. Join in about animal health and treatment courses. Call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Julia Bates is a small animal internal medicine specialist serving animal hospitals around Madison and Milwaukee. And we have UW School of Veterinary Medicine, Professor of Veterinary Medical Oncology, David Vail, with us as well. Let's go to Max in Chicago. Max, hi. What is your question?
Yeah, my question is, how can I find one of these clinical studies that they're talking about for my pets?
How do I find one? How do I enroll in one? Dr. Vail, how do you navigate that for someone who wants to be a part of a study?
Yeah, and that's where the beauty of the internet comes into play, of course. Going to sites such as the American Veterinary Medical Association, the Veterinary Cancer Society, they all have listings of potential clinical trials. You can just even go in and type in clinical trial for cancer in dogs, and a number of potential links will pop up. There are several trials going on nationally and globally for many cancer types, some that are specific to a cancer type and some that are agnostic of cancer type, looking at new technologies or new ways to prevent adverse events or side effects. In some cases, it can be quite overwhelming. Obviously, if you want to stick within your region, then going to the websites of veterinary academic centers and specialty centers in your locale.
I was going to ask just that, because do you need to be able to have access and keep going to a clinic research site throughout the clinical trial? I mean, for Max being in Chicago, you know, traveling to the UW wouldn't maybe be feasible.
Right. And more trials are now shifting from academic center alone trials to specialty access trials. So that's becoming much more accessible within someone's region, you know, within reason. There are certainly some that are excluded to academic centers, but it's becoming more widespread, certainly.
Dr. Bates, turning to grief counseling, how do you talk with pet owners whose animals have a terminal illness or whose treatment options are very limited?
That's a great question. I mean, I think just like with anything, the most important thing is to be honest and be supportive. You know, talking about the disease and talking about, you know, treatment options. And I think veterinary medicine does a good job of end of life. I mean, I think our patients don't live as long as our human counterparts. So it's something that, you know, we're talking about on a regular basis. And it's difficult to definitively explain, but, you know, the big thing is just being compassionate, which I think veterinarians are excellent at. And knowing that euthanasia is sometimes the kindest and most loving option that we can provide our pets, that ending suffering or ending, you know, pain is okay. You know, it's okay. And it doesn't, and oftentimes it means you love your pet enough to let go.
Dr. Vail, in the academic setting, how do you instruct about compassionate care and euthanizing and end of life care for pets?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily an academic thing, but from a standpoint of veterinary medicine in general, as Dr. Bates said, it's the compassion that of being a human being and seeing human beings going through problems, just being a good listener in many cases. We also have to realize what effect that has on our staff, on our nurses, and on the doctors. It can be a huge problem on a day-to-day basis. And we certainly have, you know, some centers and our academic center, certainly we have access to professionals, grief counselors that can get involved. But at the end of the day, we're just people helping people in need. And, you know, we've all been in that situation ourselves, and hopefully providing the time and the necessary listening skills to help guide people through the process.
How does the vet school approach issues of burnout and stress and compassion fatigue? I mean, we see the headlines that veterinarians are under a lot of stress.
Yeah, I mean, we're one of the highest professions from a standpoint of acts of suicide, for example, compassion fatigue you mentioned, and burnout. The profession as a whole has really stepped in the last 5 years to help provide the necessary resources, in many cases necessary, and in some cases much more needs to be done for helping practitioners, for helping our technicians and nurses, because it is a major problem.
Dr. Bates, what kind of stress do veterinarians experience that might lead to, you know, really serious mental health issues?
Well, I think, you know, Dr. Vail hit on a couple of things like compassion fatigue and, you know, the workload can be a lot a part of it.
Has the workload come down at all in, you know, since the pandemic?
I think it's coming down, but there are still a lot of clinics that are, you know, double and triple booked for people. There are waiting lists, specialty hospitals, there's still, you know, difficulty getting in to see some specialists. So I think it's definitely improved since the pandemic, but it isn't over. I think the big part is that we have a shortage of veterinarians. We have veterinarians who are leaving the field, and we just veterinarians who are retiring, and we just don't have enough to replace the demand.
Talking about veterinary care with UW School of Veterinary Medicine researcher David Vail, and we have Dr. Julia Bates, an animal internal medicine specialist. And your questions at 800-642-1234. Liz in Lyons has a question. Liz, hi.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
My first one is, why are not all veterinarians trained on how to take care of greyhounds? There's only two in my area, and there's a ton of it. And also, she has a worm that she had gotten from Florida from racing, and we adopted her after racing, obviously. But we're on the second round of treatment because they came back, and there is a drug that is not legal in the United States that works on greyhounds to get rid of that worm. So we're basically blocked from getting something that's going to cure her.
Liz, thank you for that. And I open the field here, Dr. Bates and Dr. Vail. Go ahead.
So I'm sorry, I missed exactly what she was talking about with her greyhound. I presume she may have been talking about an infectious disease called Babesia. But
Liz, is that what you are referring to?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and some of those drugs are very difficult to get. Babesia is not a common infectious disease that we see in Wisconsin. We're certainly seeing more of it, but it's one that we think about more down south, and definitely greyhounds. We think about it in greyhounds as well. And so it's off the top of my head, I can't think of the drug name, but it is very difficult to get, and you often have to get special approval from the FDA to get it in. And the tough part is, it's because we don't see a lot of it. We don't see a lot of it. So the FDA is, and the drug companies are not, it's not approved. So getting it approved can be, is a difficult process, an arduous process, right? It takes a lot of time. So drugs that are not used very frequently are much more difficult to get. One example is a drug that's very commonly used now to treat a disease called Addison's disease. And that drug that we use to treat that is not used in human patients. So in the 1980s, the late 80s, it went off the market and wasn't going to be produced anymore. But thankfully, actually, I think it was President Reagan's daughter's dog had Addison's disease. But thankfully, to someone like President Reagan stepping in, they were able to start manufacturing the drug again. And now it's very widely used and available. But unless it's a community that's it's used a lot, that, you know, just like the COVID vaccine, there was a big mandate for protection. So that was able to, you know, the FDA was able to approve and get things done a lot quicker, but usually it's a very long and arduous task. And unfortunately, I did not express that very eloquently. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Dr. Bates, for that history, though, is really fascinating. And Dr. Vail, some people get rescue dogs that are brought here from the southern U.S. Liz's greyhound from Florida. How should adoptive families navigate taking in dogs that have either had a very different life, like in racing, or that have survived a trauma in some way?
Yeah, I mean, I personally, that's with the last two dogs that I've had, and my current dog are rescues from the Deep South, from either hurricane events or something like that. There are really, really good adoption agencies, pet adoption agencies that help bring those animals up and get that initial medical care that's needed to look for some of the infectious disorders that are more common in the South. And so basic things like heartworm testing, for example, and intestinal parasite testing and treatment before they're even allowed to be adopted. So those things really should be worked through with your general practitioner, your veterinary general practitioner. Ask the appropriate questions. We all have to be advocates for our own health as well as our companion's health as well.
And what about greyhounds? Is it tougher to find care for greyhounds?
Well, I think every breed is a little bit different as far as what diseases are common or uncommon. When we're talking about, you know, dozens of different breeds, and the majority of our patient population, of course, are mixed, you know, we train our veterinarians over a 6 to 8 year period. It's pretty tough to be specialists in every breed, but we do have resources, and certainly in the age of artificial intelligence, that will become important as well, of defining or at least being familiar with how to gain information on specific breeds that have specific treatment needs or diagnostic needs.
Oh, that's interesting. I want to get a little bit more into AI and that aspect. Dr. David Vail with us and Dr. Julia Bates fielding your questions about medical breakthroughs, how to help pets live longer and better quality lives. And there's room for your question, your comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We find out about emerging technologies and treatments, clinical trials to keep our pets healthy, and the latest on how to fight cancer in dogs. We have Dr. David Vail here, veterinary medical oncology professor at UW School of Veterinary Medicine, and Dr. Julia Bates is a small animal internal medicine specialist. They're taking your questions and comments. 800-642-1234 is the number to call in. Okay, Dr. Vail, you teased it and you're up. AI, how might artificial intelligence change veterinary care? How is it changing it now? What is to come? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's more of a global issue, certainly, than just veterinary oncology. And we've all heard and read some of the frightful potential stories with artificial intelligence, the Terminator scenarios, for example. Mm. But it can be very, very helpful, especially in a world where technology and just our understanding of medicine is expanding exponentially every year. And no human that wants to have even a small amount of normal life or outside of their career can keep up with it. And artificial intelligence will allow us, with many caveats, of course, to keep as up to date on a particular area as we can be. I know it's something new, but we were playing around with it in clinics just the last couple of months, one of the newer websites, and it's profound and scary at the same time as to just what information you can get access to in literally milliseconds. So for example, the caller that talked about greyhound disease, you know, that would be a perfect example of where AI may be very helpful in providing us with the latest information at our fingertips.
Dr. Bates, what is your take on AI?
Oh, I am not nearly as well versed as Dr. Vail, although an interesting snippet is I was playing around on one of the chat APT sites and typed in something about a disease and basically said, please write a summary including references for this particular disease.
He wanted you to go to work.
And it did. And it was a very nice summary, but it was completely wrong with made up references.
Wow. That's very concerning, I would imagine, for you to see that.
It was. So my experience has probably been a little bit different than Dr. Vail's, but it was humorous nonetheless.
I mean, the internet alone, I would imagine that your pet owners come in and have a list of things that they think is wrong with their animal. And now you've got AI as well.
I think that Dr. Google, you know, we refer to it as Dr. Google. And I think Dr. Google is great. I don't have a problem when owners come in with information. I think that, as Dr. Vail said, it's important to advocate for yourself and for your pets. And I think there's a lot of great information out there just on the internet alone. And you know, there's not always great information, but I think the most important thing when it comes to, you know, information that you get via AI or just through Dr. Google, that you take it with you and that you talk about it openly about it with your veterinarian, because they'll be able to help guide you through that information. And that information will probably help you make better decisions when it comes to pet healthcare.
Dr. Vail, anything you want to add there?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's the old scenario of garbage in equals garbage out. You really have to be reticent of the fact that there's good information out there and there's bad information out there. And I just got back from the ACVAM, our college's annual meeting, and a significant portion of the event was discussing AI and the pros and cons and how we need to regulate it appropriately. And at the end of the day, take that information with you to your practitioner and give them credit for sorting it out as well.
I also want to touch down on another pressing issue, xylazine, the non-opioid tranquilizer FDA approved for veterinary care that is turning up in drugs and an emerging threat in America. Dr. Bates, how can veterinarians better control the supply of xylazine?
Well, thankfully, xylazine is uncommonly used in small animal medicine. Mm. It's much more commonly used with large animals. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not going to be as much of a problem for small animal practitioners. There are other safer, similar drugs out there that small animal veterinarians are using more commonly than xylazine. So I think that most of small animal practitioners won't be affected too much. It will put a bigger burden on large animal veterinarians, I believe, unfortunately. And then, ultimately, those type of things are going to increase cost and access to veterinary care, unfortunately. But, with this type of drug epidemics that we're seeing, I guess something has to be done, whether this is the right thing or not, I don't know. But I'm just grateful that it's not a drug that is commonly used in my practice or small animal medicine.
Dr. Vail, how do you see it, in the academic setting as being an important tranquilizer for large animals?
Well, it's a little outside of my wheelhouse, of course, as Dr. Bates mentioned, but it is a huge problem. I know we were discussing it, and we just had a meeting in Philadelphia that it came up just briefly, and that's actually the city where the combination started. But you just look at the human, the physician-based side of opiate abuse that exploded with OxyContin, et cetera. It's essentially a regulatory problem, and it's going to tighten up the availability of the drug for good uses, but it may be absolutely necessary in order to try and control the problem. But, again, it's not my area of expertise, so I don't want to go on too long about it.
No, I completely understand. And I just want to thank both of you for taking the time to answer these questions and really kind of navigate us through the issues that are advancing your profession. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
David Vail is a professor of veterinary medical oncology at UW School of Veterinary Medicine, investigator for comparative oncology clinical trials at the UW Carbone Cancer Center as well. Julia Bates, small animal internal medicine specialist in general practice and emergency animal hospitals throughout the greater Madison, Milwaukee, and Janesville areas. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.